The following is a Richmond National Battlefield Park podcast. Richmond National Battlefield Park is a division of the National Park Service, who invites you to experience your America.
The program you are about to hear was recorded on August 16, 2008. It features Ranger Mike Gorman's tour of the Belle Isle Prison Camp and was part of Richmond National Battlefield Park's series of special summer talks and tours. For more information about park special events, please visit our website at www.nps.gov/RICH. Thank you.
First things first, welcome. Welcome, everybody. This is magnificent. On a day like today, such a beautiful day, out to tour one of the very important Civil War sites of Richmond. I'm Ranger Mike Gorman, one of the historians for the Richmond National Battlefield Park, and I'm sort of the... I guess you could say the resident expert by default on the city itself during the Civil War. I find Civil War Richmond absolutely fascinating. For 4 years, the eyes of the world are focused right here on Richmond, Virginia, and in a lot of cases, right where we're standing, right at Tredegar. Everybody knew this was what was supplying the Confederacy. This is the Confederates have made Richmond their capital, and along with that comes all the bureaucracy of waging war. Now, that's an important consideration because, well, I'll give you a few little numbers here. In 1860, when the census was made, there were about 38,000 souls, white and black, in Richmond. On one day, in 1863, the Richmond newspaper reported there were 15,000 men just on Belle Isle. Now, think about that. That's Union prisoners on a very narrow stretch of land. You can see it on your map that I handed you out. Right there, the obvious one says Belle Island. That's where we're going. Now, it did not always hold 15,000 men. In fact, at the beginning of the war, it wasn't considered at all. So let's start there. Why are we talking about Belle Isle? Well, let's think back to the way the fighting gets started. In 1861, the big battle that everybody thinks about at the start of the war is the Battle of First Manassas, or Bull Run if you prefer. Who wins that one? You better believe it. The South wins that like crazy. And now we've got a problem. Both sides thought that there was going to be one big battle, and then the other side would basically collapse. The war would end. After First Manassas, did the war end? I wouldn't have much of a job if it had. I'd be in the wrong place. Obviously not. What the results of First Manassas are lots of casualties and lots of prisoners. And neither side had really thought about what to do with prisoners or wounded soldiers. Now, this sounds hard to believe. We're going to go to war, and we're not going to make provisions for prisoners. Sound like a good plan for you? No. But that's exactly what had happened. So, now Richmond becomes, just by default, the magnet for prisoners. Why? Because it's on a rail line. We got 5 railroads coming right on in here. And everybody's thinking, hey, we're going to exchange these guys. They're going to go home soon. We're not going to hang on to them forever. We're going to trade. So we want some place that's going to be easy to get them out of. 5 railroads and this wonderful river right here that can take those prisoners right on out. So one thing that Richmond has a lot of, and I can guarantee you back then it had even more, are tobacco warehouses. And the tobacco industry here in Richmond has a slight problem now with the blockade on. They're not doing a whole lot of business. A lot of vacant warehouses. So why not put prisoners there? Has anybody ever been in a tobacco warehouse or tobacco barn? Yeah, a few of you. They're designed to be hot. It's like a big humidor. They're supposed to keep people warm. So the Confederates are thinking, hey, this is a good plan, right? If they're here into the cold months, it's like a ready-made insulator. Unfortunately, that's what happened, and there's a reason why this happened. They couldn't get rid of the prisoners right away. They couldn't ship them out. And the reason for that is, well, does the United States government recognize the Confederate government? No. It's the whole war right there, isn't it? So if they start treating diplomatically with the Confederate government, that's recognition. That's recognizing the Confederacy. They can't afford to do that. So there is no diplomatic end in sight for these prisoners. Unfortunately, they stay there for a long time. They stay there into the winter time. It gets pretty bad. Squalor in the prisons. Civilians in Richmond are coming by to look at live Yankees. This was a novelty for them. Well, In 1862, the military authorities decided to fix the problem themselves. And this takes the hands out of the politicians. It's a good deal, too. Basically, what they did is say, you know what? The British government and the revolution didn't recognize us. So we're going to take the exact same plan that they had for exchanging of prisoners between the armies and do that. And basically, it boiled down like this. If I take all of you prisoner, I'm going to talk to your friends. Let's say you're all northern soldiers. I'm going to talk to your friends in the north, and I'm going to say, I've got 50 or more of your soldiers. You've got 50 of our guys. We swap. Easy enough. But what if you're, let's say, what if you are a general? Now you are worth some mystical number of privates. I'm not even kidding. They had this very strange system going on where a lieutenant was worth something like 4 privates, a major 10 or something like that, and a general was worth something like 200. So that was sort of the trade ratio. This goes on in early 1862, basically the prisons north and south, empty. Good stuff. And everything's working fine until something happens. Something happens right here around Richmond that's going to change the whole game. And what I'm talking about here is the 7 days battles. Now, if any of you have been by the park, you've seen some of them. You've seen Gaines Mill, you've seen Beaver Dam Creek, you've seen Malvern Hill. All these are part of the 7 days battles. Wonderful sights, too. But the result of this campaign is that Robert E. Lee now has jumped on McClellan's flank, and he's driven him away down towards the James River. Okay, situation has changed. The entire military situation has changed in a week's time. And we've now got thousands and thousands of prisoners to take care of. And these tobacco warehouses aren't going to cut it anymore. So what are we going to do now? Put them on Belle Island. Exactly. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here, would we? Be a pretty short tour. That's it. Yeah. They didn't do anything with them. Goodbye. Belle Isle becomes a prison right after the 7 days. And the reasons are quite obvious when you look at your map. It's an island, like Alcatraz or other places that you can think of, the Devil's Island, for instance. You can't get off it easily. The river surrounds it. Look also at the heights on either side. Here, cannon could be mounted up there to protect the camp. If you think about all these tobacco warehouses, you had to have a guard for virtually every window. You got to have a lot of soldiers to guard it. For Belle Isle, you don't. It's incredibly secure. There's also a belief that now that they've got this wonderful exchange system in place, that they're not going to be there for long. What better place can you imagine to spend a few days in the summer than in the middle of the James River? What a great deal. And at first, that's the way that the Richmond papers were describing it. I want to read you one. It's almost like an advertisement for a cruise line. This is right after the 7 days, 2 weeks after, on July 15, 1862. And the headline is, Seeing a Good Time. Said, the prisoners on Belle Isle are encamped in the lower ground of the island, within convenient distance of the water, and at all times in the full face of the breezes that almost continually sweep along the river. They pass away the time in exercises, such as wrestling, jumping, and tumbling about generally, apparently caring for nothing and nobody, and quite as contented as they can be under the circumstances. They are supplied with excellent tents and have plenty to eat. Their condition is certainly more enviable than that of several thousands of their comrades now in the city prisons. Now, don't you want to be there? Wrestling, jumping, and tumbling about generally? I mean, this is good stuff. But a year later, a Union agent for the Christian Commission, who'd been in Richmond and seen the conditions on Belle Isle, had this to say a year later. The soldiers on Belle Isle are suffering beyond endurance. There are 5,400 on the island, which is low and unhealthy. They have no tents, into which by crowding more than one half can enter at all. The remainder sleep without, on the bare ground, without sufficient clothing, and almost entirely without blankets. Many have no pants, many have no shirts, so of shoes, and almost every individual lacks some essential article of clothing. They are on half rations, have no fuel of any kind, and no soap is issued to them. They are consequently very filthy of necessity. They are dying at the rate of 8 and 10 daily now, and the rate must fearfully increase from this on. What just happened? We went from jumping and tumbling about generally to suffering beyond endurance and dying at the rate of 8 and 10 daily now. What just happened? A lot happens between July of 1862 and November of 1863. A lot happens. And those of you who've looked at the Civil War know that during that time, the war shifts from being in the Confederates' favor to being in the Union favor. And that is the story of Belle Isle. When we go through this tour today, I always want you to keep in the back of your mind, humming away at you, that the fortunes of the prisoners on Belle Isle directly mirror the fortunes of the Confederacy. Which is to say, as the Confederates are winning the war, and in July of 1862, they are. The conditions are good. The prisoners are well taken care of, but once the war starts to turn, things start to get bad, real bad, intolerably bad. And that will be what we're going to focus on for the rest of the tour. So at this point, the camp is just open. Somewhere in July of 1862, as we step off, we're going to walk down this road right here. We're going to have a short stop around somewhere down the way where I'm going to show off a photograph. Those of you who've been on one of my tours before know that I am a nut for photos. I'm going to end this stop with one. And then we're going to get on the bridge, and we're going to walk across the footbridge over to Belle Isle. One word of warning. Everybody in Richmond uses Belle Isle to walk their dogs. I shouldn't have to put too fine of a point on this one. Just watch your step. We shouldn't encounter any creatures other than human beings, but if we do, give them a wide berth. It is a city park today. This is not a national park, so do respect their rules as well as the tour. Before we leave here, I love it when we can tie in this site to something else, and I'll pass around this photograph here, which is neat. I don't know if you know this, but the Library of Congress put up all their Civil War negatives online for you and I and everybody else to view for free. And here's one of them. Again, I'll pass this around. This is looking from the south side of the river. You can see it on your map, so imagine right about where Battery 13 is. Can you see that? He's standing here, and he's shooting this way, over Belle Isle and at Tredegar. So as you look at this photograph, you can see the Tredegar buildings in the background. In fact, that is this building right there. I blew it up. So as you pass this around, you can literally see how close we are to the Belle Isle prison camp right there. This photo was taken in April of 1865. She's asking about the timing of the photographs. When were the photographs made? This is important because at our next stop, we're going to talk about the memory of Belle Isle, how it has been propagandized by both sides. And a lot of these photographs are just that, in a way, propaganda. Because they're made by Union photographers coming from the north, and they're trying to say something to us. They've got a message. And they're made right after the fall of Richmond in April of 1865. Except for one. We actually have a wartime view of Belle Isle, and I'll show that off when we get onto the prison. It's very exciting. Does anybody have any questions before we get started in earnest?
Can we have two of the maps?
Can you have two of the maps? You certainly may. As long as I've got them, you can have them. Anybody else?
One map over here.
All right, who needs maps? Come on up.
Uh-huh.
Map here.
Thank you.
Map here.
Two.
Two.
Thank you.
There you go. You need each need one? Okay. All right. And there you go.
Thank you.
Now, does everybody have a map? To orient you, if you see this cluster of buildings right here, right there, that is Tredegar. That is Tredegar right there. Next to it, right there, that chunk right there, that's the armory, which was over there. You should be able to spot pretty easily Brown's Island right there, as well as, obviously, Belle Isle. We'll talk about this more when we get over there. Anyone else have any questions?
Brown's Island
is, on the map? Right there, that little island there. It was much smaller during the Civil War. Indeed. Anyone else? Yes, ma'am. Oh, sir.
Was Belle Island the dock where they store prisoners?
Was it
the dock? No, the dock where the most important
ranks of prisoners. For most of the war, it was pretty much the prison for Union soldiers here in the Confederacy. There are others, but in terms of capacity, I'll go ahead and say Belle Isle was probably the most important. He was asking about capacity of the prison. Was it the largest? Kind of goes to how you define it. But yeah, I think it probably is.
Yeah, no,
anyone else?
So the railway she spoke about going to Belle Isle came from the south side.
Yes. We will talk about that more on the island as far as the island geography, but as you see, there is that little rail spur going over onto the island, and that is how the prisoners approached the island. Ah, well, no, there was just that one spur, but we'll talk about how they got on the island once we get there. Anyone else? Then, off we go. I'll get you just a second. Sir? We're going to cover Andersonville, but Andersonville is only open in the last year of the war. 1 year. For all its notoriety, 1 year. All right, so off we go. As I said, we're going to walk right down this road. We'll have a short stop and then on to the footbridge. Please follow me. All right. I love to stop here because it's really close to where this photograph was made of Belle Island. You are looking right now at Belle Isle, right over my shoulders there. Obviously, the large bridge that you see here was not there. I'm going to pass this around so everybody can get a good look. Just pass that around for me. And do make sure I get it back. I'm not a rich man. You can see here the same photograph. Note, in fact, the photographer is probably somewhere right over there. That's probably where he was. Now, note the hill right here. You can all see that on your map, too. All right, that high, prominent bluff there overlooking the prison. It's totally covered with trees today, and you can just see it past these pillars over here. Now look to the left of the photograph and you see the prison camp area right here. Flat, low, directly in our front, right where this bridge now runs across, unfortunately. But that's where we're going, and that is the prison camp. Now this is what Belle Isle really looked like at the end of the war in 1865. But all during the war, Harper's Weekly and Leslie's Illustrated News were publishing images like this. Again, what are they trying to say to you here? They're trying to paint Belle Isle, and more specifically, the Confederate treatment of prisoners in general, as barbaric, cruel, arbitrary, violent. You can see starving men here in the foreground, all over here. Look, there's an officer kicking a guy right back in there. Now, where's the hill? So prominent. You think the artist was ever there? You think he ever saw Belle Isle? No. This just shows you how national interest in Belle Isle was. The guy's never set foot there, doesn't know what it looks like. This is just what he's heard, and that's what he's interpreting for people. This is how we get these impressions about Civil War prisons. Were they awful? Did they become awful? Absolutely. Was it something that we would sponsor today? Absolutely not. On the other hand, I can assure you that similar things were going on in northern prisons. But rather than start a which was worse debate, we're just going to look at Belle Isle today. If anything, I want to take the rhetoric down. I want to understand Belle Isle. I don't want to accuse people. I don't want to condemn. Would I have done it differently? Perhaps. Did I live in those times? No. So there's a lot of different ways to look at this, but I'm going to look at it in terms of let's get to the heart of the problem. Let's get to the heart of the matter and understand what happened there rather than just be emotive. Though that certainly plays an important role because it colors everything that you'll read about Belle Isle. Everything. And there's another issue. Because after the war, there was a big pension debate. And I'll tell you what, if you guys had gotten wounded in battle, you were entitled to a pension for the rest of your life. And a good one, too. Good money from the government. Now, if you'd been laid up in prison and suffered from dysentery and wasted away within an inch of your life, guess what? No pension for you. You lose. Now it becomes incumbent upon the former prisoners to convince everybody that this is wrong, that we suffered. It was awful. And you need to hit us up with a pension. And so guess what? All these books get published. All these articles get published telling about it. It becomes this almost like a concentration camp in terms of its violence, its cruelty. And what's interesting is once the pensions were finally granted, all those books kind of dry up. Kind of says something to you, doesn't it? So I want to emphasize again that everything you read about Belle Isle is colored. Trying to peel back those layers like an onion and get to the core of the thing is often difficult. I'm not saying I've done it. I don't think anybody's done it. You can't go and read the book on Belle Isle. Why? Because nobody's crazy enough to try it. But what I am saying is we can just attempt to get close. And that's what we're going to do today. We're going to hear from some of the soldiers who were there, and we're going to try to get a hold of what was going on. Now, at our last stop, we talked about the exchange system. And how good it was, and how it was working, And after the 7 days, it is working. These guys are shuffling out of there after a few months. They are moving through the system. Now, that's all fine. And, of course, the newspaper continues to describe the place in rosy terms. And I love this one because you can sort of visualize it from here. Imagine the prisoners all over there on the island. And the Richmond Dispatch of July 26, 62 said, "The Yankee prisoners now encamped on Belle Isle seem determined to make the most of a bad job and enjoy themselves in the best fashion possible. The majority of them are quartered in tents, and they have dug wells, either for the purpose of obtaining better water than is afforded by the muddy bed of the river, or to bathe in. They are permitted to go in the river by the dozen, and there is hardly a moment in the day that squads are not vying with the rocks in disturbing the equanimity of the noble James. The island is approached by a boat, starting from near the Tredegar Foundry, but few persons are allowed access, except those called there by official duties." Now, the only person with official duties to go to Belle Isle today is me. You're all welcome to come. Obviously, it is a city park, but just imagine stepping into one of those little rowboats and rowing over right about where we're going to cross on the footbridge to go and visit Belle Isle. The prisoners themselves would have entered on the south side, so as you approach them from this side, you'd be one of the elite few with the food and the supplies. Now, does anybody have any questions before we go ahead and walk on over to Belle Isle? I admit I'm not going to try to stop on the bridge because it just doesn't work and we're too big. One thing I want to mention just for sanity's sake, it's happened before. There is a tendency with large groups of people to walk in step. Now, you will look and you will see this footbridge is a suspension one. And if we all march in step, we will very soon get that thing to swaying pretty good. It's not going to tip over. It's not going to kill anybody. But I guarantee you, me at the head of the group, I might be behaving a little strangely by the time we get to our next stop. So help me with that. And as in the military, they say route step. Anyone with any questions? No. Okay. Well, again, watch your step for the dogs. For the dogs, yes. And off we go. Our next stop will be on the island, in the prison. All right. Now you are essentially standing in the Belle Isle prison. This earthen berm that you see today marks the northern boundary of the prison. Or if you want to look at your map, we are right there. That rectangle there and its addition represent the prison camp. And that's exactly where we are. And if you superimpose the Lee Bridge on this map, we just came straight across this way. Right down here, and we're now standing right there. Oh, I'm sorry. There you go. We're right there. Everybody get a good look? Okay. So that's where we are right now. And we are blessed once again with a wonderful photograph showing almost exactly where we're standing. If we superimpose this group in the photograph, we would be right there. Now this photograph is made from right up there on the hill. Everybody see the hill up there now? And if that were denuded of trees, you can see why this would be a great place to put a cannon up there to sweep the camp in case there was any kind of mass revolt. If you look basically right where the cannon is pointing, you can see a number of small structures and tents that would have served as the guardhouse, the kitchen, any number of support facilities right there. And that would have all been just over here where you see this concrete bit today. Now, as you look around, you can see some structures on the island. Obviously, the bridge here is... I don't need to tell you that wasn't here during the Civil War. But none of these structures were either. After the war, an ironworks basically spread out from its wartime location on the south end of the island and took over this site. So much so, the returning prisoners sarcastically remarked that, the place where so-and-so suffered and died is now the corner of a rolling mill. So this place was absolutely taken over by industry after the war. So what you're looking at are remnants of that. In the 80s sometime, I remember it being done, they determined to archaeologically find where the berm of the prison had been. And they did. So what you're looking at is not the original. This is not the original. This is a recreation of it. Now, one thing to consider, back to our sort of mini theme of propaganda. If you look at this photograph, you will notice something on the horizon. Can anybody tell me what that is right there? It's the Virginia State Capitol, which was also the capital of the Confederacy. Now, this photograph is a very loud statement. It's almost the photographer saying to us, the Confederates, and the former Confederates now, are going to say, well, they didn't know what was going on in Belle Isle. They had no idea how bad it was on Belle Isle. This photograph is designed to refute that. It's to say you knew. You could see it from the steps of your Capitol building. Powerful. Very powerful image. Why don't y'all pass that around so everybody can get a good look. Now, when we left our last stop, 1862 has commenced. Prisoners are moving in and out of here very rapidly. By 1863, it's all going to change. Who can tell me what important event happens on January 1st, 1863? The Emancipation Proclamation takes effect. Now, one of the very important things about the Emancipation Proclamation, whatever your feelings about it, is that it allows for the enlistment of black soldiers to fight for the Union. Now, when the Confederates understand that this is going to happen, the Confederate Congress goes absolutely ape. You're going to do what? This is servile insurrection. That's what they're saying. You're going to be essentially encouraging all our slaves to rise up, join the army, and go south to kill their masters. So, again, the Confederate Congress goes way too far and issues a proclamation. Now, has anybody seen the movie Glory? If you haven't, do it soon. It is a magnificent film, and if you like movie stars, I don't know what to tell you. It's got Matthew Broderick, Morgan Freeman, Denzel Washington. Great stuff. Great stuff. I could go on and on. But there's a wonderful scene in it when the Confederate Congress passes this resolution. Those of you who've seen the film can remember this. He's in the rain, and he's going to announce this to his men. And the proclamation goes something like this. Any soldier, any Negro soldier taken in arms against the Confederate government will be immediately returned to a position of servitude. What does that mean? We're going to make you a slave. Doesn't matter if you grew up free in Boston, you're now a slave. Any white officer taken in arms leading such Negro troops will be summarily put to death. Okay, that sounds pretty powerful language. Now, if I take all you prisoners, throw you in here, Belle Isle, and lock the gate, in any nation today, is it going to be okay that I turn you into slaves? No. Do you think it was okay back then? No way. When the Union, well, I wouldn't say the Union troops, when the politicians in the North get wind of this plan by the Confederates to do this, they throw down. They say, fine, you don't want to treat our soldiers, black soldiers, sure, but soldiers, as prisoners of war? Fine, don't do that. We'll just halt the system of exchanges. And that's what they do. The Confederate Congress digs in their heels and says, we're not budging. The North digs in their heels and says, we're not budging. So remember, that system that kept prisoners cycling in and out of here very quickly now comes to an abrupt end. And when does it come to an abrupt end? In the spring of 1863. Now, I don't need to tell you Civil War types out there what's going to happen in the summer of 1863. A lot of things are going to start to change. Fast, fast, fast. You've got the fall of Vicksburg, Gettysburg, Chickamauga, all of these happening in fast proximity. What this is essentially saying, though, except for Chickamauga, the war is going the opposite way. And now there's no way for prisoners here in Belle Isle to get out. So it goes from being a place of jumping and tumbling about generally now to absolute despair. You can imagine what the soldiers are feeling in there as they know that the only way for them to get out is for the war to end. And a lot of them start to feel like their country has abandoned them, has left them to rot. And that colors their memoirs, their recollection. So if you haven't gotten the idea, a lot of this is colored. I don't know what to tell you.
Was there any kind of, government organization within the prison?
He's asking about, is there any kind of prison government, like amongst the prisoners? We're going to touch on a few of these strange events, not in any formal fashion, no, but there were some sort of unwritten rules.
I guess the
The Confederate, he's asking who was taking care of their daily needs. Well, as you saw in the photograph, or it's still out there somewhere, you've got the kitchen, the cookhouse, the guardhouse, and the hospital all in this area. So there was a Confederate staff. The guards here tend to be, emphasis tend to be, not regular Army soldiers. Remember, part of the advantage of this place is so they don't need to spend a lot of guards to guard all these windows in the tobacco warehouses. They can just have a small battalion of local defense troops guard the place. So the guards tend to have a connection to Richmond. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as well. But in general, the ones responsible, directly responsible for the prisoners are the guards here in the prison. There is an important man we need to talk about briefly who's in charge of the whole show. It's this guy, John Henry Winder. It's spelled like Winder, but it's pronounced Winder. Now, he is basically in charge of all Union prisoners in Richmond. And we can say a lot about him that was not pleasant. But a lot of people after the war remarked that if he had not died in early 1865, he probably would have been hanged at the end of the war. So who's the bureaucrat? Winder. He's the one shuffling the papers, making it happen. Who's on the ground, making it happen? It's the guards here at the prison. Now, remember just a second ago we were talking about the exchange breaking down. Prisoners here are here to stay. And now you have the battles of Gettysburg. A lot of prisoners. Chickamauga. A lot of prisoners. They're coming in here, and instead of decreasing numbers and then moving new guys in, they're just adding to the number. This prison was originally created to hold 5,000 men. Temporarily. And now, just like that, we're going into 7,000, 8,000, 9,000, 10,000. It just gets worse. We have a lot of quotes from men from this time. And I've tried to select some that are pretty fair. And here's one of them. This is a man from the 1st Connecticut Cavalry. This date in his diary was July 26, 1863, so this is after Gettysburg. He said about how he got here, "We were marched across a long bridge to Manchester." Anybody want to take a guess what bridge that was? Anybody from Richmond? It's the Mayo Bridge. He's talking about they marched across the Mayo Bridge, and then on your map you can see the Richmond and Danville Railroad, which is right over there. You can see the cars on the tracks over there. They march up like this and then onto the island. Okay, so that's what he's talking about. He says, "We were marched across a long bridge to Manchester. There is no bridge from Richmond to Belle Isle, but there is from Manchester to the island. The prison was made by digging a ditch about 3 feet wide," which isn't here anymore, "and throwing the dirt on the outside, thus making a breastwork behind which the guard was stationed. The ditch was the deadline. If a prisoner attempted to cross that, he was shot without a word of warning. The enclosure was about 400 feet long by 250 feet wide and was filled with old tents. The lieutenant in charge of the prison was of French descent and very quick-tempered. His assistants, two sergeants, were both very cruel, hard men." And for those of you that are interested and know the name, Henry Wirtz, the infamous commander at Andersonville, was indeed stationed here at Belle Isle early in his career, and probably one of those sergeants referred to. Another soldier named Aaron Bachman, he was captured at Gettysburg, 1st Pennsylvania Cavalry, said, "We were confined on the island where there was no chance of escape. There were 5,000 soldiers on about 10 acres of sand, and it seemed that every grain of sand had a louse. We had no stockade. There was only a bank of sand about 4 feet high around the island." He says it's 4 feet, so this is nowhere close. "The guards were on this bank and we were on the inside. Our food consisted of 1/3 of a loaf of cornbread per day, the loaf being about the size of a brick. We had a little meat for one day, and every other day we had soup. An ordinary wooden bucket full was the allowance for 20 men." Think about that. "The soup was made from 4 quarts of beans, some bugs, and dead worms, and James River water." Yeah, now that's when everybody goes, "Ooh." "I'll take the bugs and the dead worms, but leave the James River water alone." I don't know what that says about us. But "Those who had no cups had to do without or put it in their shoes." Now, admittedly, he's laying it on pretty thick there. But I can tell you that one of the most controversial things when you read these people's memoirs is how much food they were issued. So he says 1/3 of a loaf of cornbread per day, which is about the size of a brick. So imagine a brick and cut 1/3 of that, and that's what he says they were given in terms of bread every day. And then it gets the James River water soup. But that gives you an idea about probably pretty fair about what they were served every day. Now, another important point to make, because the food is so controversial here, does anybody recall an event that happened in April of 1863 here in the city of Richmond?
The bread riot.
That's right. In 1863, on April 2nd, interestingly enough, the same day that Richmond will eventually be evacuated, a group of local women basically ran amok in downtown Richmond demanding bread and generally, well, that was their idea at first. It kind of got out of hand and they started looting jewelry stores and stuff. But it really shows you that the Confederacy is not able even to feed their own civilians. Now, if that is the case, how much food do you think the prisoners on Belle Isle are getting? Not very much. Now, don't say that by way of an excuse, just an explanation. The blockade has affected everybody, from the Richmond civilians to the soldiers in the field, and certainly to the prisoners here on Belle Isle. Now, that's not their problem. Their problem is they're not getting any food. And that is certainly compounded by the fact that it's getting cold. Now, if I throw you all in Belle Isle right now and lock the gate, are you ready to go for winter?
No.
Look around. Everybody's got a t-shirt on, shoes, you know, shorts. You got a blanket? No. You certainly haven't got an overcoat. Well, that's the problem here. These guys are all captured when? Summer. They're not walking around with their blanket tied to them, ready to go. And if they had their blanket when they were captured, a lot of times it was confiscated from them. So by the time they got in here, when winter comes on, it's going to be bad. And nobody had planned for that. And all of a sudden, now, in 1863, you're having these guys over the winter. Imagine being here. Imagine being where we are right now with the wind coming down the river, with the ice coming out of the sky, with the river freezing, and being here on Belle Isle. Just an awful thought. Now, as we proceed on down, we're actually going to walk straight down the middle of the camp. This gravel path roughly approximates a prisoner's road that was here. They called it Broadway. I don't think they put on any musicals there, but you can imagine on either side of this, as the prisoners described it, streets running at right angles with this. And that at night, when it was cold, the men would sort of walk in pacing fashion up and down Broadway just to keep warm. So that's where we'll be walking as we go to the southern boundary of the camp. Anyone have any questions? Now that the exchange system is broken down and things are getting bad, aren't we chipper? Yes, sir.
If they were bringing in more prisoners, why didn't they just expand to use more of the iron?
They did. That is a thank you very much. Without your map, the original camp. See this main rectangle. He's asking why didn't they expand to fit the increasing number of prisoners? Because the camp originally was just this one rectangle right there. Now look here. See this L-like thing shooting off there? They added that in 1863 because the numbers were just so high, they could not all fit in here. So all that's over there, right over there. Everything we're walking through here was the original camp. Does that make sense? So they did, but it's going to get bad. It's still not that big of an addition.
Well, it seems like they still had more room, though. I mean, would it be hard to take care of it if it had expanded anything?
Unfortunately, there's not much. If you look at the map, there's really not much more else that it could go. These black shapes that you see on the south end of the island, these are actually an ironwork. Some of the buildings' ruins are still over there, but you know that's their property. They can't just commandeer it. So this is basically what they're limited to. It's just this tip, this sandy flat tip, right here of the island. Anything else, they're just not going to be able to guard them, and it's just not going to work. Now, I want to emphasize to you, this is not the only prison in the South. There are prisons at Salisbury and Ellis Milliken in South Carolina. There are others that are holding prisoners as well. But what's happening also, when they do have exchanges, the rare cases where they do, this becomes sort of the holding, everybody will come to here, like a funnel, right? And they'll all be here. So at times, this place is just out of control crowded. We're talking in the neighborhood of 15,000 men during those days. You can imagine how awful that would be. Anyone else have any questions? Yes, ma'am. I love it when people anticipate what we're going to talk about at our next stop.
Oh, okay.
I love it. You're right there with me. We're doing good. We will cover that. I promise. She was asking about their guards. Weren't there escapes? Coming up. Coming soon.
Was fishing allowed, or that was just problematic?
Was fishing allowed? Hey, that's a good question. I have never seen any sources that say that it was or wasn't. I've never seen anybody say that I did it. But it would not surprise me, especially in 1862. Yes, sir.
Was Battery 13 here for defense of the city, or was it built for the camp?
Okay. Everybody take a look at your map. You see Battery 13. He's asking about was it there for as part of the city's defenses, or was it there for defense of the camp? I think both. And the reason I say that is if we extended this map out, and this is a wonderful map, by the way. It's made in 1865 by the Union Army Corps of Engineers. This is sort of on the inside of a ring of forts that went all the way around the city. It's called the Inner Defensive Line. And Battery 13 is actually inside all of that. And it doesn't really have any purpose for being there except because Belle Isle is there. But it is certainly part of the inner defenses. Maybe if somebody tried to come down the railroad. I don't know.
You don't know when it was built.
Oh, it was certainly built in 1861-62. Sometime in that neighborhood. Built by slaves, usually. They're always out there trying to get more slaves to come and work on the fortifications. But all that's going on in 1861-62. They were never tested, as far as I know, and fired in anger. It seems to have been. It seems to have been. Just for Belle Isle. Anyone else?
How high was the river back then compared to it is now?
How high was the river? Compared to today, I think it was a lot higher, but that's because the river is so low. If you look at this photograph from 1865 that we passed around, you get a sense that the river is pretty high back then. I think in general, the river was higher back then than it is today, maybe by as much as a foot.
They didn't have a lot of dams up
there. Exactly. There weren't a whole lot of dams back then. I think the 20th century agriculture has changed a lot in terms of the character of the river, but it was much higher. And more importantly, I think if you want to relate this to why didn't more prisoners try to escape, I don't think as many people knew how to swim back then as they do today. In the 20th century, we put a high premium on the Coast Guard and the YMCA put a high premium on teaching more people how to swim. But you'd have sailors drowning from falling off a boat in the James River. Sailors. I mean, you'd think if somebody could swim, it would be a sailor. But it happens. I just typed up an article the other day about that. You know, you think, wow. But I think that's another factor as well. You know, to us, it's a jump in the river, swim. You know, but it's not as simple. Anyone else? All right, we are literally going to march down through the center of the prison to the actual entrance of the prison where everyone would have admitted to the prison for the first time. Please follow me. And you have just passed through the Belle Isle prison camp. I'm always sort of reminded of that scene in Field of Dreams where the guy can't see all the baseball players and he walks right through the home plate. And the ball flies right past him, and the guy's angry at him, so he's about to beat him with his baseball bat. But that's what we would have done. If we were that back in time, we just walked past and stepped on thousands of men that were right in here. And for all of them, this would have been the entrance to the camp. Again, on your map, remember, there's the rail spur. Right there's the rail spur just over there. You can see the rail, the cars over there on the railroad. So they would cross, they would walk across that bridge, and up like this. Now, everybody who came onto the island remarked about sort of an initiation procedure, and it's sort of similar to, you'll see it in prisons today. They would the old prisoners would sort of gather around and start chanting, "Fresh fish, fresh fish," and then they would pass in, the new ones would pass into the prison, and they'd just give them a going over, just anything that they had. You know, if they had a jacket, they'd pull that off. If they had a blanket, they'd pull that off. It was done. Not the prettiest of things, but this is a view of the bridge. This is the prisoner's view onto Belle Isle. So this is what you would have seen. You can see the covered railroad bridge. You would have passed through that. I think it's somewhat symbolic to my mind. You know, it's this like Sleepy Hollow going through this, you know, scary covered bridge and then onto the prison. That was right over there. Now today there's a footbridge on the site of this. It's no longer a rail spur. So you can actually access the island on a bridge that runs exactly where that was. It's sort of emotional if you get over there and imagine yourself as a prisoner, you know, coming in and walk right up like this. That's exactly what they did. This is what they saw of the island.
Where was that picture taken?
All these photographs, you can well just assume that they are 1865 in April. In general, that's when most of these were taken. I want to now break that mold.
Just go back to the issue on photographs. Who would have been taking these photographs?
Well, there was really three major photographic presences that came to Richmond. One under the auspices of Matthew Brady, who's probably the most famous Civil War photographer. Another under the auspices of Alexander Gardner and his crew. And the other was under the auspices of the E&HD Anthony Company. Interesting point about them. Anybody remember Viewmasters? Viewmasters were made by Ansco, which was the direct successor to the E&HD Anthony Company. It's a direct line. So they were making the 3D photographs, the stereo views. Absolutely. He's asking about the price of the photographs. When you see these photographs of the Civil War, I actually have a talk I do with exactly this point. I mean, come along next time. But the point is these photographs are not made by us. Today, we just take a picture and you don't even think about it. You don't even care. But back then, it was a serious investment of time and money just to make that image. Remember the one I showed you from the hill? You want to schlep a camera up the hill? With all the developing chemicals and everything in jars, I mean, this is real work. You don't do that accidentally, all right? So you got to always think, these photographs are made for one reason and one reason only, to sell. They are not documentary pieces. They have documentary elements. There's a lot in these photographs that we can use as documentation. But at their very core, there is something they're trying to say, like the one with the Capitol in the background. It's a powerful, powerful message. And there'll be another one I'll show you in just a second that's similar. So always keep that in mind. The documentarian nature that we sort of assume, you know, today just didn't exist back then. This was a serious, serious business. And that's why this photograph really stands out. This photograph was made in 1863 during the war. This is one of the extremely few. I mean, you could count them on your hand. Outdoor views that came out of Civil War Richmond. So when you see this picture, the tents are full of Union prisoners. The men in the foreground are Confederate guards. In the background is the Confederate Capitol, surely flying the Confederate flag, but obscured to our view. The quality of the image is not that great. This is an incredibly rare shot. And it shows almost exactly where we're standing. You can see in here the earth berm that I'm standing on right now. So we are right there. It's exactly where we are. Nothing can tie us to a site like a photograph like this. It's as close to a time machine as we will get. So please pass that around.
Are any of these images available online?
That one, no. That's in a private collection, although I believe the Valentine Museum has a copy, and I don't think that's online. My website, okay, I'll toot my own horn, Civil War Richmond, mdgorman.com, is chock full of them. So if you go to the Belle Isle page, a lot of these will be there. A lot of them will.
Who bought that picture?
Does
anybody know?
The photograph that I just showed you was made by a man named C.R. Reese. Here's a neat little tidbit. Who else from Richmond, by the way? Most people? Yeah, he did. He wound up in Petersburg after the war.
Right.
And he died significantly after the war, but you've all been to his grave. The dog in Hollywood Cemetery. That's his little daughter. Died during the war. And if you look at the plot, it says C.R. Reese. He does not have a stone, but I checked, and he is buried there. So you've all been to his grave. You all know it. And he was a photographer in the war. He actually served in Richmond Home Guard and was probably one of the guards at Belle Isle at one point. That's how he probably got access for these photographs. I mean, you know, photographers say, I want to take a picture of this place. Isn't going to be successful. Okay? He has to have an excuse. And his excuse was probably that he was in good with the guards. But he came over here and he took at least two photographs from up on the hill looking down this way. I chose that one because it actually shows the earth berm. The other one does not, but you can see it in the visitor center. I have it up there in the photo display. But Reese was a fascinating man. I wish I knew more about him. He's the only photographer whose views of wartime Richmond survived. Unfortunately, the only views we have that he took that survived are all of prisons. He took pictures of Libby Prison and Belle Isle, and we know that the guards were selling prisoners those pictures. And in a lot of cases, that's how they survived, because they got taken out of Richmond with the prisoners, because his gallery burned to the ground in the evacuation fire. And he must have had other negatives in there. Jefferson Davis is inaugurated right behind his gallery. Come on, you took a picture of that. You know, the Confederate Congress was meeting right over his shoulder. He took a picture of that, but it just got destroyed. It's all gone. So maybe there were more, but we'll never know.
How would the prisoners have
This was a big issue. The guards, he's asking, how would the prisoners have bought those images? Well, a big problem, if you're a Confederate, was the fact that the guards were trading with the prisoners, because the prisoners have something that the guards want. What?
Greenbacks,
that's right. Real money. When you're talking about the guards, they're getting paid in Confederate money, which is basically best used as toilet paper. So you got these prisoners here that have got, you know, $5 slips sewn into their jackets, and here come the guards saying, you know, hey, what would you like? That's how they're, in a lot of cases, that's what made life tolerable here on Belle Isle for these prisoners, was to buy things from the guards. Things like blankets, things like overcoats, and, you know, frivolities like photographs. And at least in one case from Libby prison, we have a soldier who said, I bought this from a guard, and I'm marking it with an X. Here's the window where I sleep. So it was definitely taking place, and it made their lives a little bit easier. So that's another thing I want to point out. Remember what I just told you, the guards have an incentive to actually kind of make nice with these prisoners. So remember the engraving that I showed you right at the start where the guy's kicking? That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I mean, maybe there were a few sadists in the crowd, but if I'm a guard here and a local civilian, and I got a chance to get these greenbacks, every day I'm going to go to the market and pick up some fruit, some vegetables, something, you know, some cloth, bring it up here, and sell it.
So there was an underground economy?
Very much. He hit on it just right there. There is an underground economy going on here at Belle Isle, a black market, if you will. And that is often how these prisoners are able to tolerate things. On the flip side, there is sort of, if you will, a dark side, because what would often happen, and the soldiers wrote about this, was that if a guy got so sick, so debilitated, that he really couldn't fend for himself, that these rather odious characters they called ralliers would sort of descend on him and take his food, his blanket, his clothes. And everybody hated these guys. But they were sort of organized bunches, and these sort of fights would break out over this. It's really kind of disgusting, but I've got a few quotes about that. But first, let's sort of back up. I want to sort of, it'll lead into what we already said. But I want to point out something that happened very close to here that explains how this place started to get very disease-ridden and very filthy. Originally, there was, well, okay, let's just answer the question, how'd they go to the bathroom? Okay? I always want to know, quite frankly. Well, the answer to that is, this is the gate. There was sort of a wooden fence like this, right here. And what you would do is you would come out, walk right down there, and down to the river. And there was just sort of an area of really stagnant water where they called it the sinks, or the latrine, and that's where you would go. Well, once the exchange system breaks down, you're basically given access to the water. Okay, so you got to swim through about, you know, 10 yards of human filth, but that's the river, and you can use it to escape. And believe it, they started to do that. They started to try to get out that way. Now, what do you do if you're a prison guard? You got to shut it down. So what they do is, at night, this gate is closed. You don't get to go to the bathroom at night. Now, that'd be pretty rough for us. But the number one disease in this camp is dysentery. Now, they called it chronic diarrhea. And that's a pretty apt description. So you can well imagine, if they can't get down to the river, what are they going to do?
Go in there.
Yes, ma'am. They are going to go right in there, and they're going to cover the camp with filth. And it's understandable. And I'm not making this up. Guy we've already heard from, Weston Ferris from the 1st Connecticut Cavalry, said, they had on one side of the camp a lane built, a high board fence, to the river where were the sinks. At night, only a few were allowed out at a time. And when cold weather came on, none were permitted after dark, and the camp presented a most filthy appearance in the morning. Another guy named Roland Bowen from Massachusetts Regiment said, the latrine is down by the riverside. Formerly, we were allowed to go out to it during the night, but some took advantage of this and swimming the river escaped, after which the gate was closed at dark and no man allowed out. As there were 6,000 prisoners on 3 acres of ground, you must know that the condition of the camp in the morning was filthy beyond description. They had men detailed to clean the camp every morning, but it was not half done. Much of the offal being covered up rather than carried away. And I think I may safely say that 1/4 of the filth has never touched at all. Again, the cleaning is neglected entirely for days at a time, and should the prisoners be kept on Belle Isle until the return of hot weather, the health of the camp will be in a terrible condition, and the mortality fabulous. And you're getting a pretty good taste about what's really going on here. It's not an active attempt to destroy these men. I do not follow that argument. I do not think that the Confederates are out to destroy these men, but you can really see, imagine living that way for 6 months or more. What would that do to you? What would that do to your psyche? I can't even imagine it. And as we already talked about, you can engage in trade with guards to alleviate this, but then you have that dark side. Prophet Ferris goes on, he says, there were many thieves in the camp who would steal overcoats and blankets and sell them to the guard. See, it's going back the other way. These ralliers would sell the overcoats back to the guard, who would then sell back to the prisoners. It was about the same as murder to steal a man's blanket. After that, we tied the blanket to us so that we could hang on, and they would have to take us in order to get the blanket. Private Bowen from the 15th Massachusetts, he called them rapiers, and he said, I have known the rapiers to make a furious attack on a few loaves of bread. Then there would go up a hideous yell, and clubs would fly, and bread too. In an instant, there would come forth a throng of rapiers and anti-rapiers, men with clubs and knives, and men without either. The fight would become general. The bread would be torn into 1,000 atoms, most of which could be found in the sand the next morning. After the disappearing of the bread, quiet would again reign, some going away to walk the street again, others to their tents, some to see if there was not more bread to rally on, some with marks of the dirk, some with sore heads, declaring if they knew who was the cause of it, they would kill him, some laughing that they had gotten a good paw in and made a good grab. A number of the rapiers lost their lives in these melees. It is no crime on Belle Isle to kill a man. On Belle Isle, if a man kills a rallier, he is a good fellow. And the man that steals his gravestone is no sinner. He really hated those guys. So that's what's going on here in 1863 as we head towards the winter. The winter of 1863-64 was one of the coldest on records. Some prisoners said, although I have a hard time believing it, that the river froze solid. Whether that happened or not, that gives you an idea how cold it really was. And this is when the really bad times hit. We are talking about guys freezing in the middle of the night, dying, 10 men at a time. Now, you might say, why don't we resurrect the exchange? Why don't we get that going on? Well, if the North says we're going to exchange prisoners with the South, again, they're condoning their behavior towards black troops. They can't do it. They can't afford to do it. It'd be a political disaster. And so it goes. And we'll talk about the end of the camp at our next and our last stop. You have a question? Yes, sir.
Yes. How come if there were gays here?
Yes.
And it was nighttime and it was like the wind and the river froze solid, couldn't, since the trench was only about like 4 feet deep, couldn't they just climb out and just get on the
He's ice? Asking, why didn't they just climb out? They've got about 7,000 guys here. Why don't they try to overwhelm the guard and jump on out of the prison and escape? Well, there's a, why not everybody get together and break out of here, jump over the ditch and go. Surely just a few men would get killed. Well, the problem is the Confederates have anticipated that. And as you can see on your map, you've got Battery 13 overlooking the camp right up there. See that apartment complex building over there? That's where it was. It's on high ground overlooking the camp. You've got the gun up here. In fact, there may have been more than one. And guns over there where those houses are today to sweep the camp in case of any kind of mass revolt. You can well imagine what a couple of stands of canister would do in a densely packed situation like this. If there was a mass outbreak, that cannon fire would pretty much put it down. Now, interestingly enough, at nearby Libby Prison where the officers are kept, there is a mass breakout where they tunneled out in 1864. And 109 men got out. About half of them got recaptured and half of them made it to freedom. But that is the largest mass outbreak of the war. Didn't happen here. It's hard to find cases of successful escape attempts from Belle Isle. It just rarely happens. Just rarely happens.
The south side of the river is a little harder to get to, firstly because it's so far away.
But right.
With the rocks
exactly.
Rushing through, it probably wasn't really feasible to make it across over
there. He's asking about the south side of the river. Was it feasible to go that way? You'd have to, I mean, right over here is like Guard Central.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, to do that, you'd be super sneak to even get there. Sure, you could have hopped the rocks once you got there, but I think just getting there was so improbable. And it's sort of, you know, it's a problem, too. If you have any clothes left, which you probably don't, If you do, it's a blue Union soldier's uniform. And you've just broken out into the capital of the Confederacy. What are you going to do? You're not going to go down to the local hotel and say, I'd really like a room for the night. You know, it's not going to happen. So you're going to be in a bad way. So a lot of the escape attempts that do get carried off, what you see is it looks like a really daring, you know, initial attempt. But it's like once they get past that initial attempt, it's like, oh, now what do I do? And, you know, in a couple of cases, they're actually captured in the city, you know, pretty obviously. So at least one case, the guy turned himself in. I can think of one where he swam the river this way and got up on the high bluffs and turned himself into a surgeon at, I think it was Winder Hospital.
Did anybody actually break out and make it back north?
Did it happen? I'm sure it did. In terms of me finding, you know, this is the guy that did it, or here's his account, I've never seen it. Now, you see it at Libby Prison because, you know, you've got the mass outbreak, and a few guys did it at other times as well, but not here. It's strange. Go ahead.
Which one were in Jackson? Union soldiers, could they actually buy off uniforms?
This kid would have made a great prisoner. He's asking, couldn't they buy from the guards uniforms? Yes, and they did. I've never seen one of them who used that method to escape, but I bet you they did. I've seen it at Libby Prison. I've seen something similar happen. But I like the way you think. If he ever gets put in jail, we're in trouble. Use your powers for good, son, please. Yes, sir.
A question on prisoner exchange.
Please.
Were going on.
Yes.
Was it by name, or was it by, here's 20 guys, go?
He's asking about prisoner exchanges. How did they do it? Was it by name, or was it by their rank? It was really by their rank. What you would do, as we sort of hinted at earlier, if all you guys were privates, we'd have no problems. If I take all you prisoners, I keep doing this, I'm sorry, I don't want to take you prisoner, but allegorically, if you're all my prisoners and you're all privates, no problem. We just, you know, we take 50 or so privates from the other side and swap. Now, if you're a general and you're a lieutenant and you're a captain, now we start having some ratio get involved, and the general there is worth, I'm making it up, 200 privates, and the colonel there is worth, you know, 50. And so that was sort of a bargaining chip. And that's honestly a lot of the reason why Libby Prison was where it was and where it was kept separate, was because those were your money, you know, right there. So if you had your colonels, you'd get more privates back.
Now, so when these Union soldiers were exchanged and went back, I'm assuming they went back into the army. Assuming they were healthy enough to do that.
Okay, what happens when they are exchanged? His question is about do they go back into the army? The thing is, the exchange system first paroles you. Now, this is just like a parole today from a prison. You basically give your word of honor that you will do or not do certain things. And in this case, the do's and not do's were you will not take up arms against the Confederacy until you are properly exchanged. Now, what that means is the exchange is a bureaucratic process where Union and Confederate representatives meet and actually officially in paperwork exchange you. The parole, however, gets you out of here while you're waiting on the exchange. So you're at home, and essentially, you have a vacation. A lot of the reason that, remember I was telling you about the pensions earlier on? A lot of the reasons that this became policy after the war, where they did not give prisoners pensions, is because there's a long-standing belief in the North that people who got taken prisoner wanted to be taken prisoner so that they could get that little vacation. Now, it's not ridiculous. In 1862, it was probably happening. A lot of guys weren't too terrified of getting taken prisoner. So if, you know, they were close to the rebels and the rebels came, I mean, they don't actively go, here we are, come take us prisoners. No, I mean, you know, if you can imagine today, if the enemy's coming at us, what are we going to do? We're going to run. But, you know, maybe they don't do it as vigorously as they might.
Wait, just to clarify something.
Go ahead.
All right. So I'm in prison.
Yes. Well.
He gets picked to be exchanged. I get let out. I go home, so to speak.
Yes.
Or go someplace.
Right. Bingo. Yes. The parole system gets you out of here. Basically kicks off the exchange process. You leave here, and the bureaucrats bureaucrat it out, and then you're eventually exchanged.
How long would that be?
Could take a while. Could take months.
Oh, it's not days.
It's not days. No. It would take a long time. But the problem now is, and it happened to both armies, okay, we've got these guys on parole, and now when they get exchanged, how do we get them back? They're at home. They're comfy. And believe me, they're going to come up with 1,000 excuses why they can't come back to the Army. So what they start, both sides start to do is have these parole camps where you did not go home. You went into the, basically this camp, and they treat, you know, if you came out sick, they would treat you for whatever disease that you had. They would, you know, bring you back to health if you could be, or if you had to be discharged, they would discharge you. But then you were in a concrete place where, okay, once you're exchanged, you're there, you know, we're going back to the Army. And it worked. It did work. But as you can well imagine, both sides started accusing the other of debilitating the soldiers so badly that when they were paroled and exchanged, that they could not go back to the Army. That was an accusation that was levied on both sides. Was it official government policy? I really can't imagine that. I really can't. Anyone else have any questions? These are good questions, by the way. This is the fun part. Anybody else?
You may touch on this in the next.
I probably will.
But burial of prisoners.
I love it! This is great! She's asking about burial of prisoners. And once again, we've had somebody anticipate the theme of the very next stop. Great group. That's exactly what we're... In fact, we're going to the former cemetery. So that'll be our next stop. But so hang on to it. And if I don't answer your question there, we're gonna cover that. Anyone else? Okay. Right now, we're going to do something a little distasteful to me. We're actually going to cut through these tall weeds. I apologize. There is no other way. I tried. I'll beat the path, and maybe some of you can walk, you know, sort of obliquely, so we'll beat down a nice bit of weeds. So if this happens to you, I apologize, but do give yourself a once-over in general for ticks tonight. I don't want that to happen to you. All right? So off we go. Actually, they didn't really have an administrative headquarters so much here. I mean, there was an office for the guards, but in terms of the, you know, who's here and, you know, when are they going to get exchanged, that was all actually handled down at Winder's office downtown. But, you know, in terms of what would they have here, it would have been records like, for roll call purposes, usually just a number, and they would literally walk them out of the prison and then walk them back counting as they went. You know, if you might, you know, here's the fixed point, and then you just count 1, 2, 3, you know, and that's how they would do it. So they would know if anybody had died or whatnot. They had, it was basically run like a military camp. I mean, you had sick call in the morning and a reveille, all that kind of stuff. Very similar to Army life. The problem was, we'll touch on this a little bit more at our next stop, there is such a belief in the prisons that it's one of these, you know, urban legends that if you went to sick call, if you reported a sick call, the Confederates would take you to the hospital and find some excuse to amputate a limb or in some way make you disabled. Was that the truth? No. The irony is, when they got to the hospital, they found, I've never seen a negative account about this guy named Higginbotham. It's like he was like this angel of mercy, and everybody described him that way. So, I mean, this guy must have just been over the top good. And he just, you know, everybody said, you know, that he just worked wonders. So the irony is, a lot of people wouldn't even go to him because they were afraid of this perception of what he might do. But the truth was, when they did get there, it was probably the best treatment they ever got. So the sad part is, a lot of guys never reported a sick call and wound up dying.
Did the prisoners get greenbacks after they're in prison sent to them by the Army or anything like that to replenish? $5 won't go very far.
You'd be surprised. The question was, were the prisoners getting shipments, like you might today from the Red Cross? The answer is yes. The Christian Commission and the Sanitary Commission both made it their mission to bring in provisions for the prisoners. And the Confederates were happy to do it. Great. You know, come on in, you know, take care of these guys. What they often were doing, and they got caught a lot, would be, you know, here's a glass of jam. And inside that glass of jam would be, you know, rolled up in the center, would be some money. And so they knew what was going on. Somebody mentioned the underground economy. I think it was you. That's a very good way to look at it. And the Christian Commission and the Sanitary Commission were playing into that. They knew it was going on. Here's some money to facilitate you doing it. Now, I like to have this be our final stop here at this site because for a lot of soldiers, this was their final stop. This is the site of the prison cemetery. And once again, we are absolutely blessed to have a photograph of the area where we're standing. Now, the cameraman here is standing right back over there in what's the now wooded green area over there, looking back towards where I am, where we are. And what's so fascinating about this shot is that you can read the headboards of these graves right here in the foreground. So much so that you can go and find them today. They've been disinterred from here. This is now officially an empty cemetery. There's nobody buried here. They're all now buried in the Richmond National Cemetery. Did they get them all? No. There's no way. So when we talk about this being hallowed ground, that's not some hokey park ranger thing. That's the truth. Here, pass it around, please. Another thing about that photograph. I want you to go back to the mini theme we've been developing about messages of images. And look at what the cameraman must have spent several minutes to frame right between all these trees right there. This is even more powerful than the one with the gun up above. You can see that he spent a lot of time moving the camera back and forth just to get the Capitol building poking out between those trees. Again, you knew. You knew what was going on. You could even see the graveyard from your own Capitol. Powerful, powerful stuff. The guy in the photograph that you see looking like he's weeping is actually one of the cameraman's assistants named John Reiki. So in some ways, this is staged. This is deliberately pulling at your heartstrings and pulling at your political point of view. That's what it's designed to do. It's as American as apple pie. Don't blame them. But it's good for us that we have these photographs because we see what this was like. And you can see this area on your map. It's actually marked really well. You can see here's the initial camp, the main rectangle. Here's the L, and then look, just past the L, you can see the gravestones there. Everybody see that? So as we've already indicated, there weren't a whole lot of ways for you to get off the island once the exchange system broke down. There were a couple of ways. You could, of course, escape. Very rare. You could swear allegiance to the Confederate government and take a job. Maybe if you were an iron worker, you could get a job in the nail works right over there, or maybe a treader. How many people do you think did that? Not very many. Why? It's going to get out. Word's going to get out. Back to your folks. You did what? You swore allegiance to the Confederate government, turned your backs on your hearth and kin? You wouldn't be able to go home. So not many people did it. And you could get so ill that the Confederates would parole you by sort of a special flag of truce boat. And that's noteworthy because we have pictures of some of the prisoners who were shipped north in this system. And they look like concentration camp survivors. Again, that is trying to get you to feel a certain way. To people in the north, they're looking at it and they're saying, you are starving these prisoners. But we know a lot about these guys. We know who they were and what they were suffering with. They were all suffering with intense dysentery. They were sent north because the Confederates were afraid they were going to die. And the irony is they got their picture taken, engraved in Harper's, and now everybody thinks they're starving the prisoners. Again, everything is colored. Everything is biased. You've got to cut through that. Was starvation happening? Certainly. If I fed you one-third of a loaf of bread, cornbread a day, and maybe some James River buggy water, y'all wouldn't be looking too hot either. Compound that with the fact that they're drinking water out of the wells that's filled with human excrement, they're all going to get dysentery, and that is going to compound the problem. Dysentery is slow starvation, and that's what's happened. And of course, the last way off the island was to wind up here in a grave, and it happened all too often. In October of 1863, the Richmond Sentinel, a different newspaper now, it really has no reason to lie. Remember, this is a Confederate newspaper. It says, there are now confined on Belle Isle 10,500 prisoners. Imagine that. Imagine them all crowded in here. While nearly every factory and storehouse in the lower part of the city is filled to the utmost capacity, and accessions are daily being made to their number, far exceeding those sent north by flag of truce buzz. What are they saying? It's getting worse and worse. So conditions go from bad to awful. As I can tell you, the economic condition in Richmond continues to disintegrate. The civilians, soldiers in the army, and of course prisoners here are deprived of food, clothing, anything that would be approximating an ordinary life. They're not getting it.
Ordinary life. What did the guys do?
The soldiers?
Yeah.
Well, you would certainly expect regular issues of clothes, food, clean water, something like that. Just wasn't available to certainly the Confederate soldiers. I mean, if we have an image of the Confederate Confederate soldier. He certainly doesn't even look like me. You know, he's a gaunt, wiry fellow, maybe not wearing a whole lot of shoes. Is that absolutely correct? No, but it's pretty close to the mark. You know, this is a hard life. It really is. Occasionally, yes.
I'm just thinking today, that's a difficult thing to do.
It is very difficult and involves...
How did they mechanics of get the message that, you know, John Doe, who lives in, you know, Boston, Massachusetts, is here?
Great question. All right. He's asking, how did people in the North know who was even a prisoner of war? Number one way was right after the battle, and this happened really wherever you live. Remember, regiments are recruited from an area. So let's say it's Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. You all are from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. The Harrisburg, Pennsylvania Courier, or whatever it is, the newspaper, is going to regularly receive updates from, maybe they'd even send a correspondent to hang out with their regiment. And after the battle, he'll write back with a casualty list. And if you're living in Harrisburg reading that courier, you know, after every big battle, you know, it must have just been awful to think of that paper, you know, going and reading it and maybe seeing your son's name or your brother's name or your father's name. And that's what they would do. Now, they'd also compile the list of the missing. Now, that doesn't mean they're prisoners of war. That means we just don't know what happened to them. In general, they're prisoners of war, but that might mean he got killed and we didn't see what happened to him. Or maybe he was wounded and died in the hospital and nobody knows it yet. But all this would eventually, basically, accountability in the regiment would take care of that. You'd have to know where everybody was. And eventually, the Confederates would report to the Union government, we have so-and-so and so-and-so. And that's...
done with reasonable sincerity and honesty.
Oh, yes. And same with the parole system. The interesting thing about the parole system is, remember I told you, I'm going to let you guys out of prison, but you have to give me your word. You have to give me your word that you're not going to take up arms against me. What are y'all going to say?
Sure.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Right, Mike. Yeah. We'll not shoot you. Right. Just let us on out of here, and we'll be good boys until you exchange us. Today, we'd be blowing that off like crazy. But back then, they took it bloody seriously. You gave your word of honor. And I tell you why they took it seriously. If you got captured again... after having given your parole, and they capture you again, and there's your name on the parole register, you weren't supposed to be fighting, guess what they can do to you now? You can be hanged. That's right. So, it's very important back then. They took it very seriously, deadly seriously, and you'd have regiments saying, guys, we're not going to put you back in the front line. Just come and be in the camp, you know, do guard duty and stuff. And they'd be like, you know what, that is violating my parole. I'm doing military duty. I can't do that until I'm exchanged. Now, maybe what they're really saying is, I sure like the vacation I'm on. But in all honesty, they were very concerned about the honor of the situation. And it worked. Today, it wouldn't work. It's just a different time. It's just a different time. Now, back to what we were talking about as far as the cemetery itself. Private Bowen of the 15th Massachusetts, captured at Gettysburg, has a great quote about the cemetery here and what life was like when people died. And he described the men that he saw wasting away in the prison. And he said, some of these men were nothing but skin, bone, and lice. And quite often they would be suddenly relieved of all earthly cares, being found dead in the ditch in the morning. We would take them out in a blanket, and by order of the Confederacy, a pine board coffin would be made, the lousy carcass placed therein, taken up the island a little distance, and buried with a pine board placed at his head with appropriate inscriptions. You can certainly all see that in the photograph. He says, one day while we were out to count, what does that mean? They pass out of the prison, and they pass back in being counted as they go, so you know how many men are actually in the prison. One day while we were out to count, some of the prisoners got into the boneyard and stole a large number of headboards and brought them into camp to burn. They were using headboards as firewood. I suppose, he says this sarcastically, I suppose this was done so that when their friends come down from the north to take their remains home, they may be more readily found. That leads to another problem that we have as historians trying to figure out what actually happened here on Belle Isle. How many men died here? I can't tell you. The reason I can't tell you is because the way that they treated sick patients here at Belle Isle would be to take them to a prison hospital in Richmond. So they were taken off the island. Now, if you die in that prison hospital, did you die on Belle Isle? See? How do you count them? Now, when the Christian Commission and the Sanitary Commission came back after the war and started disinterring graves from here, They found a very much smaller amount than you would expect. I think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 or 200. Now, you would think I meant 1 or 2,000, but I said 1 or 200. And the reason for that is because so many of them died in prison hospitals in town and would have been buried somewhere else, at Oakwood Cemetery or Hollywood Cemetery. So we don't really know, and I can't tell you, because the records for this prison, what should be there is not there. It either got burned accidentally in the fire, the evacuation fire, or was burned deliberately. So I can't tell you how many men stayed here, how many men died, how many men lived. So we'll have to content ourselves with the notion that we can just get a taste of it and that there's more work to be done. Now, eventually, the Confederates realized that this is not the best place to put prisoners. And there are a number of things that caused them to think that. Number one, the Libby prison breakout in February of 1864. My God, 109 men escaped from prison, and they could have gone and run amok in town. They could have, started basically conducting a private war in the streets of Richmond. What do we do if it happens here? What if we have a mass revolt and these guys run amok in the streets? And then something happens that puts that fear into clear focus. Has anybody heard of the Dahlgren raid? Ulrich Dahlgren and his raid at Richmond? For those of you who haven't heard, it's a cavalry raid in 1864, in March of 1864. And it's designed to basically sweep down the river like this, cross over onto the south side of the river, sweep up the bank like this, come into Belle Isle, liberate the prisoners, turn loose the prisoners in Richmond. And orders in Dahlgren's pocket when he was shot and killed said not to let Jefferson Davis and his traitorous crew escape alive. What does that mean? We are talking about sanctioned assassination of the Confederate president. If you're a Confederate, how does this feel to you? Is this okay? Is this an okay way to fight war? Remember, they've already felt assaulted by this. First of all, now blacks are in arms against them, and now you've got this cavalry raid that's coming down to kill the Confederate president. To them, this is below the belt. This is awful. This is just what we'd expect from those Yankees. I'm not saying that. They're saying that. That's how they feel. And they're thinking, what if that had happened? You spring 7,000 guys out of Belle Isle and turn them loose in the city. You think they're going to be nice guys and go order an ice cream cone? Oh, no. They're going to be torching the place, looting the place, burning the place. It's going to be a disaster. And the Confederate people of Richmond start freaking out about this. And the Confederates, interestingly enough, had already determined that we need a new prison somewhere else. And they'd started building it. And then the Dahlgren raid happens. And they say, forget the building of it. We're sending them there now. Where was that place that I'm talking about? Andersonville, Georgia. That's right. It's actually America's Georgia, but it's called Andersonville. So that's what leads into Andersonville, is the panic of having these guys maybe break out. And remember, the exchange system is over. So we can't get these guys out of here. Might as well send them somewhere south. The irony is, Andersonville was supposed to fix all the problems. Supposed to fix all the problems that Belle Isle had. Better ability to get food to them. There's nothing around there. They don't have to feed a civilian populace. But the irony is, all those problems were supposed to fix. It didn't. Just created a whole new setup. But that's another story for another place. Actually, no. In a lot of cases, they would take the trains. They took the trains. There are accounts of, how do I want to put this? The prisoners here on Belle Isle are not inclined to leave it unless they're going home. So how do they get them to leave it? They tell them they're going home. It's sad. There are scenes where the Confederates announce an exchange, and the prisoners, I mean, you can just imagine, these guys have been living on fumes emotionally for months, and now that exchange is announced, and they're just crying and hugging each other, and, you know, I'm on the first batch, here, take my blanket, you'll need it more than I will. And then when that train turns south instead of east to go to City Point, every heart just must have been crushed. I mean, it makes me emotional to think of that. But that's what they did. So Andersonville becomes a prisoner just in the last year of the war and continues in operation until the end. Belle Isle, it's only used again as a holding pen during Grant's overland campaign. Now, Grant had a different attitude towards prisoners. He formally and forever halts the exchange. He says, I'm not going to ever revive the thing. Remember, that's what both sides have always been hoping for. Maybe we could get this going on again. But he says it's not going to happen. Why? Because if I take a guy out of the field, if I take him prisoner, I don't want to have to kill him again. I want to take that guy out of the field once, and I want to get it done. And what that means is, If you hear that and you're already a prisoner, how do you feel? You feel like your country has just walked away from you. And worse, this is an election year, man. This is all coming to a head in 1864. And it's a big issue. Lincoln's going to have to deflect it during his re-election. He's going to have to defend that position. So, Belle Isle basically is empty. By 1865, when the Union Army captures Richmond, the only people here are a bunch of now freed slaves who are very happy to see the Union cavalrymen. But you can well imagine every Union soldier who's coming into Richmond in that first wave is thinking, I'm going to be the guy. I'm going to be the guy that liberates Belle Isle. Here we go. You know, and heads on down there. And when they swing the gates wide, it's just the former slaves. And that's interesting, too. Because with all the former slaves that are flooding into Richmond to try to find their families, their loved ones that have been separated from, for in many cases, years, this becomes one of the places where they're sort of refugee. It becomes sort of a camp for freedmen. And nearby, they'll have some Freedmen Bureau schools. They'll teach them to read, write, become good citizens, all that kind of thing. That's all going on. It starts here at Belle Isle. So think of it this way. It goes from a place of absolute despair to a place of hope. And Richmond wasn't very interested in remembering what happened here at Belle Isle. Oh, they spent plenty of time deflecting the criticisms, the coloration of the accounts. But as far as the site itself, very quickly after the war, covered with new industry. And that's what they're after. That's what they're after. Bring on the money. Bring on the industry. That's what happened. That's why you got these buildings here. And by the time I was a kid, virtually everybody had forgotten that this ever happened. There was no commemoration, no marker. This wasn't even a park. And now look around. You see people coming here for fun, for entertainment, for recreation. And how ironic would that have been for the soldiers who suffered so long here at Belle Isle? They would love for scantily clad women to be passing them by. I don't mean to jest, but it seems sort of ironic to me what you have this site used for today versus what it was used for back then. Now, I hope I've shown through the course of this tour how the soldiers' fortunes here on Belle Isle are exactly the same as the Confederates. It starts off high and goes downhill until there's very little left except for Andersonville. I don't want to place blame at anybody's feet. I hope I haven't. I've tried to be fair, but I hope that that's something that you'll place alongside your own feelings about the place for just a little while. So I thank you very much for coming on my tour today. Thank you.
This has been a Richmond National Battlefield Park podcast. For more information about Richmond's battlefields and the park's other podcasts, please go to www.nps.gov/RICH. Thank you.